Welcome to the Activation Podcast, brought to you by the Conscious Resistance Network. I'm your host, Derek Brose. In every episode of this podcast, we're going to explore solutions in the areas of health, permaculture, growing your own food, technology. We'll be interviewing guests who are providing important solutions that are more important than ever in this time we are living in. The Activation Podcast is focused on bringing you cutting-edge solutions to empower humanity.
Hey everyone, this is Derek Brose with the Activation Podcast, and this week we're bringing another important guest. This is actually going to be my first conversation with Catherine Austin Fitz, and I don't think she probably needs an introduction from most of my audience, but we'll get her to tell you a little bit about her work. But before we bring her on, I do want to say that the conversation that you're going to hear, I believe, is going to be one of the more important ones I've had recently. She has a wealth of knowledge and has been doing this work before myself and before many of us who are out here now trying to raise the alarm bells about the direction our world is headed in. She's someone who has seen the direction it was headed in for quite some time and has tried to use her platform, her voice, and her words to get people thinking not only about the problems, but also about the solutions. And as everybody knows, at the Activation Podcast, we are very much focused on solutions. And I'm also excited to say that Catherine Austin Fitz will be speaking at the Greater Reset at the end of January from the 26th to the 30th. She'll be participating online, as well as James Corbett, Robert Kennedy Jr., and many other great speakers. So I want to invite everybody to check out thegreaterreset.org and see how you can be a part of this movement as we focus on solutions over the coming years and coming decades. So welcome to the show, Catherine. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. You know, I think of it as the People's Reset.
Yeah, that's our alternative name. If you go to the Greater Reset website, you'll see we have sort of a flashing thing that says People's Reset, Greater Reset.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. I think that's the whole thing, right? Is like we want people to recognize this is our opportunity to shape the direction the planet's going. You know, I often tell people that, and maybe you would agree with this, that one of the one of a few things that these what I call the predator class has correct is that many of the systems are broken. Many of them are unsustainable. Many of them do not work for the people. Now, of course, they helped create them and now propose themselves as the, you know, the ones to save things. But we're trying to get people to think about, as you know, how are we going to shape the direction of the future we're headed into? And that's really what I want to talk with you about today and get into some of the nuts and bolts, but really just kind of maybe get behind some of the technical side of what we're talking about and really speak to you more as an individual and as a person, as a human, and see if we can get some ideas in the audience's mind. But before we get to that, as I said, you've done so much work. I mean, you've been prolific over the years. I know the first time I came across your work was probably 2008, 2009 in From Freedom to Fascism. And anyone who remembers that documentary, which, wow, very much correct and on the nose about what we were headed towards, as Aaron Russo was with his work. So I've been familiar with you since then, and this is unfortunately the first time we're getting to connect digitally and talk. But if you don't mind, could you give some background, that whatever you think is relevant to the conversation today?
Sure. So I grew up in West Philadelphia. So I'm an American, and I watched my neighborhood be destroyed by mortgage fraud and narcotics trafficking. And I decided very early on, you know, what is this thing called money that everybody keeps thinking they can make money by destroying neighborhoods and families? I'm going to learn about this money thing and figure out how we can turn it around. And what I didn't understand when I started is that if you're going to understand how the money works in a neighborhood or a county or a country or a place, you really need to understand the whole global financial system. Anyway, so one thing led to another, and I went to college and then to business school and then went to Wall Street. And I figured out pretty early on a lot of the money was sort of run by the financial markets. Went to Wall Street and had an unbelievably fantastic and successful career. I loved Wall Street and I loved working there. And I became a partner of a firm named Dillon Reed. And then a lot of us went into the first Bush administration. And I went into the first Bush administration as Assistant Secretary of Housing. And one of the reasons I wanted that job was it was one of the, outside of the Federal Reserve, it was the richest database on all the sort of place-based data in the federal government. I worked there for 18 months and had a very bad relationship with the Secretary, kept ordering me to break the law, and I wouldn't. So I left, and I came out of the Bush administration convinced that the leadership was going to use new technology to centralize control in a way that was going to be very bad for all of us. And so I thought, okay, well, we need another plan. And I had discovered the internet and digital technology when I worked in the Bush administration. And so I started a company that was designed, it was an investment bank, and the goal was to use digital technology to radically re-engineer the capital formation and allocation process so that literally communities could finance privately with equity and get government and sort of the big guys out of their lives. Anyway, the company was phenomenally successful, and then we ran into the buzzsaw. We had won a contract to be the lead financial advisor to the Federal Housing Administration at the Department of Housing and Urban Development where I'd worked. And we were asked to implement a $10 billion mortgage, defaulted mortgage auction process, which we did. The problem was that the people had been taking money out of the back door from HUD, and sort of the corruption that had been going on was slowly getting stopped and squeezed out. So, you know, if you were going to take it back, if you're going to start doing more predatory lending and sort of have a mortgage bubble, you needed to get rid of the honest guy. So I ended up in an 11-year period with the Department of Justice sort of litigating about a whole variety of false allegations made against us, both by them and a sort of insider whistleblower. Anyway, when that process was over, it was kind of like an 11-year a graduate school in deep state tactics, you know, legal tactics, financial tactics, physical harassment, smear tactics. So I really became convinced that, you know, technology was going to use to centralize control, and that what I needed to do was to start literally, think of this as an intelligence network, of people who could help each other understand what was going on in the world and take action. So if you come into Solari Report, which is one of the two businesses I started, it says our tagline is live a free and inspired life. And my theory is, if each one of us can just avoid giving energy to the bad guys and try and find a way to live a free and inspired life, the more of us who walk out of the system and live a free, inspired life, the less we're going to give them energy and support them. So that was the idea. And I also started an investment advisory company, and for many, many years worked with individuals and families. And that's where I discovered the absolute financial devastation resulting to American families from what I call the great poisoning, which is the deterioration in food, the deterioration in water, the deterioration in the air and atmosphere. And then, of course, vaccine injury was a major, major cause of sort of financial havoc. So that put me in a position where when the pandemic started, a lot of, you know, the pandemic is what, in the neighborhood I grew up in Philadelphia, they used to call it the beatdown. So if you lived in an African American neighborhood and you grew up in one in the 50s and the 60s, you know what a beatdown was. And I would say the COVID-19 pandemic was the first global beatdown I'd ever seen. But it's, you know, if they've been using the beatdown technology for generations and building up to this.
Yeah, and I appreciate that introduction. It's good to hear more about some of the background of what you've been involved in, and so folks have an understanding of your experience that you're bringing to the conversation. Talk a little bit about that, you know, in terms of the beatdown, as you put it, and just witnessing that from the neighborhood you grew up in and the community you come from, right? As you said, with African American communities, seeing the impact that the Wall Street and the financial sector can have in real life on communities like that. And then now right. Witnessing the same thing, as you said, on the global level with COVID-19, because clearly COVID-19 is affecting the poorest among us. It is affecting people with, you know, mental health issues. It's affecting people who are already doing not too good are not doing any better, you know, in the right. Face of COVID. And people who maybe thought they were doing pretty good are now right. Maybe dealing with a little bit of difficult circumstances. So maybe talk a little bit about that. And do you feel that is by design? You know, that's not sort of any sort of accident of COVID, that is one of the goals of this operation?
So when I finished litigating with the federal government in 2006, I published a book called Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. I just sent you a link for the Spanish version. And I published it to help to help my family, friends, and anybody who cared to know, to understand that there is a concerted effort by a very small group of people to centralize control of the sort of control systems on the planet, whether it's the financial system or governments. And that is an absolute criminal conspiracy. This is RICO. And they are absolutely trying to build a very tight central control. And digital technology gives them the opportunity, particularly if they can convert the financial system to 100% digital system. It gives them the ability to implement complete control and literally take us out of a world with markets and currencies and democratic process into a world literally returning to slavery.
Yeah, it's a form of digital slavery. And, you know, that's one of the topics I do want to get into. I know you focused a lot on the concerns around the push towards central bank digital currencies. And, you know, my audience is very familiar with these topics as well. I find it interesting because going back for a moment, you were talking about some of the work you were involved in administration or maybe right after, where it seems like maybe you had at least at a period, had hopes that digital tools could be used to empower some of the communities you were talking about, like you said, kind of giving them tools to take care of their own finances and things like that. Do you still have any hopes for that? Or do you think, you know, any attempts to use digital technology in those positive ways are lost? Or what are your thoughts?
So I'm one of those people. I love digital technology and I love financial tools, you know, and I love digital financial tools. And the problem is they're very powerful tools. And if you have a governance system that's untrustworthy, the governance system can use those tools to control centrally. But there is no doubt that a governance system that you or I and your audience would think is excellent could use those tools to build, you know, tremendous wealth. So, it's like any powerful tool. You can give a laser gun to somebody competent to use it and trustworthy to use it. You can give it to a caveman and get a complete mess. So, you know, we're in a world. Whoop. Sorry about that. That's a wonderful ally of mine. We're working on a symposium for tonight. Anyway, so if you give powerful tools to people who are looking to use it to engineer central control, you're going to have a very significant problem. And that's where we are. So it's not the tool, you know, the tools aren't good or bad. I always keep using the analogy. You can use a hammer to build a house or hit somebody over the head. Hammer's not good or bad. Question is, how do you use it?
Yeah, and I really think that this is a point that myself, and I know you recently just spoke with my colleague Ryan of Last American Vagabond, that's where I write articles, that we have had some conversations around this as well, because I agree with you. I mean, I think, unfortunately, the cards we've been dealt are not, we have benevolent people looking over us and, you know, trying to guide the planet to a great place where we can all benefit. As you said, if maybe those circumstances were different, perhaps the tools would be readily available and there would be no need to worry about, you know, whether they're going to be used for good or bad. Unfortunately, that's not the reality we're in. And as you said, these tools can be used, all tools can be used for good or bad. Right. I mean, and that includes the internet that we're on right now, that we're broadcasting through right now, right? It can be used to broadcast propaganda from the state, or it can be used to broadcast messages of freedom. And I think that it's clear that the folks from the United Nations, the World Economic Forums, the Great Reset, obviously these, this kind of milieu, they have plans for central bank digital currencies. They have plans for using another tool, blockchain, in a way that is not about privacy. It is not about decentralization. That is not about freedom. And it has some really worrisome implications. I think most of the audience will be familiar with that, but I would love to hear you, in your own words, outline some of your biggest concerns with that push in that direction.
So I'll tell you what my number one biggest concern is right now, because I think one of my favorite quotes is, to be a hero, you must first survive. I want to do everything in my power to stop the vaccine passports from going into effect. And I want as many people as possible to resist and not adopt them and not go along with the system. If you look at the building of the smart grid and digital technology, we have in place in the Western world We have a covert social credit system already in place. Each person is under, in my opinion, under 24/7 surveillance with AI and software, and there is a feedback loop trying to control them, manage them, herd them in a whole variety of ways. It's all done sort of very covertly. Parts of it are not legal, but it's one of the reasons people look around and say, why aren't more people doing anything? They're terrified because they're under 24/7 surveillance, and the AI and software is, you know, people get fired, people get killed, and they have an invisible enemy. I think, what was it? I think Glenn Greenwald called it the one-way mirror. They know they're operating behind a one-way mirror, and if they're not careful, you know, they could lose the ability to support their family, feed their family, et cetera. So we have this covert vaccine passport system in place, you know, and the smart grid going up and making it more and more powerful. The minute, Derek, that they get legal approval for the vaccine passports as they build out the smart grid and 5G technology, the speed at which they can bring up a transaction control grid will dazzle most people's minds. They just can't imagine how fast, because they don't see the covert side of that being built and built and built and built and built.
Yeah, I think you're correct as far as how exponential the growth is with this type of technology. And even having these kinds of conversations, and more recently, a lot of my work and my investigations have been focused on the metaverse, what the World Economic Forum is now calling the great narrative. I just did a two-part investigation on that. You know, they're making it clear, like they need to control the narrative here, right? And it still, I think for some people, seems very far off in the distance. Like, I hear you, they're working on these tools, but, you know, this doesn't seem like everyday reality to me yet. Maybe they'll do this in 10, 15, 20 years or, you know, 50. They, as you said, though, the tools are already in place. They have a lot of the machinery ready to go, and it could literally be thrown up overnight. And to your point of the concern around the vaccine passport, and obviously the bigger picture, which is the social credit score, that in many ways people, I was trying to pull it up, I can't find it right now, but I wrote an article last year called Social Credit Scores Already Here. And this was just one mechanism of what you're talking about it. And it was basically private companies that are out there that are already gathering publicly available social media data that many people have voluntarily put out, combining that with your bank records, with your credit history and a few other factors, maybe your arrest records. And then they are just kind of putting together a number, and then they're selling that database and that information to companies who are interested. So there are people already creating social credit scores. It might not be implemented from the government just yet, but you're already being judged by, you know, absolutely. People have already, one study I found that over 100,000 people around the world, you know, and it's a rough estimate, but I think probably even higher, have already lost jobs because of this social credit score, because of their past actions and things.
And so, I will tell you, there are tens and if not hundreds of millions of people who haven't gotten jobs because of that invisible system.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't doubt it.
I call it the data beast. It's been operating. You know, I know what I was building when I was running Hamilton Securities was a software tool called Community Wizard, where we were aggregating all the data that the government has on the economics of place, you know, so taxes paid and then government money spent. And if you look at how the money worked by place, what you realized was the economy was much, in other words, people were much poorer than they needed to be. We had the ability to re-engineer that money and create fantastic amounts of wealth, county by county, place by place. But instead, the money was engineered to create control and, of course, to pump up publicly traded stocks. So rather than optimizing the government money, it was very engineered, and it depended on total secrecy. The amount of money and resources that are spent by the U.S. government to engineer secrecy are fantastic. We've spent many, many years trying to bring transparency to the effort to engineer the whole economy through the government and keep the whole process secret in a way that, you know, a few can be benefited with taxpayers' money. And literally, you know, inequality is engineered by secret government money, is what I will tell you. That's how it works. And the, you know, part of the challenge is if the leadership is going to keep this system going, they need to assert tighter and tighter control. And one of the reasons is from 1998 on, we've seen $21 trillion go missing from the U.S. government while our pension funds are stuffed with U.S. government paper or sovereign bond paper from around the world. I call it a financial coup d'etat. And now that people are ready to retire, they need to pull the plug before, you know, they don't want to tell people, oh, by the way, we stole all your money. And it's very interesting. I don't know if you're aware of this. The Biden administration had proposed a new bank regulator who just got had to have her name withdrawn. And one of the reasons is she published an article in the Vanderbilt Law Review in October, just, you know, very recently, 2 months ago, that proposed that all the bank deposits in the country be moved to the Federal Reserve, thus shutting down the entire private banking system, all credit unions, all community banks, move to the Fed, and that way, if inflation started to increase, you could just shut off everybody's money.
Yeah, it's not surprising to hear that, but I hadn't come across that. I will find that, include that link in the show notes for those who want to follow up on that. And this is something that you've talked about for years. I know that you've done plenty of interviews, including with James Corbett over the years, about the missing trillions and about that scheme that you were just describing there.
Right.
And with that background and understanding that, it does make perfect sense that, you know, it's hard for, I think, some people without the full picture and the pieces of the puzzle,
right,
you know, the financial aspect, what you're talking about, missing trillions. It's like, oh, where did COVID come from? All of a sudden, there's a push for central bank digital currencies. This didn't come out of nowhere. This has been like a carefully crafted narrative. And
right,
as you said, it's sort of, in many ways, they've been papering over the inflation and papering over the debt for years and trying to, you know, keep the machine going. And now they have the excuse of COVID that anything's wrong with the economy, they can claim it's because of COVID-19. But as you have
Right. So I always say it's the magic virus. But if you look at the existing systems that operated starting in 1998 when this financial coup began, what you had were you had sovereign governments that had the ability to issue debt. What you've done is you've levered them up, taken the money out of the old system and put it over here in a new system. Now, you keep telling people in the old system, oh, we have no money. That's not true. You just moved $21 trillion out of this governmental system and put it over here. Okay, so the money's still around, whether it's in bank deposits or it's in assets. You just moved it into a different system, and that's why I call it a coup d'etat. You're talking about re-engineering the fundamental form of government by putting the assets in a new entity and then trying to tell everybody that the old entities are bankrupt, because now the pension funds that are supposed to fund the retirement are full of treasury securities that are collateralized by this old system where the money's not there. So the question is, okay, you've moved the money, you've stolen all the money, you've had the bank robbery, there's no money left in the bank. How are you gonna explain to people that you're out of money? Well, along comes the magic virus and you just blame everything on the magic virus and what the magic virus is doing to the economy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so it's a marketing scheme for your consolidation. You're trying to convert the financial coup to a complete global coup because you're trying to essentially strip the sovereign governments of all their power. And that's what we're watching. We're watching the central banks country by country, whether they're putting a central bank in as the Secretary of Treasury, putting a central banker in as the president of the country. You're literally watching the central banks, you know, who've traditionally controlled monetary policy now assert control of fiscal policy as they re-engineer the governments.
Well, it's a brilliant scheme, is it, right? I mean, it's like you said, it's using the magic virus to blame everything on, and some people are unfortunately not clued in enough and are not paying attention. I want to probe a little bit further about this idea of the digital tools as tools, the digital technology as tools. And I'm curious your thoughts. Have you, in your experience, and I don't know, you know, to what depths you've bothered to go into things like private cryptos and DeFi and some of these newer tools that, again, seem to have some positive potential, maybe in isolation outside of the surroundings we're in. But yeah, do you have any thoughts on that as far as whether you think those are worthy tools people, you know, should learn more about? Or is it kind of like you feel like that whole arena is just bought and sold already and maybe not worth our time?
Hold that thought. Guys, before we go any further, I want to tell you a little bit about a project that I recently launched. called the Holistic Self-Assessment Online Course. Now, some of you know that I released this book, The Holistic Self-Assessment, in April 2018. And essentially, this book is the culmination of the experiences I had when I went to prison, dealing with addiction, dealing with depression, and suicide attempts. This is the process that I took myself through to get to know who I am, to get to know my principles, to get to align my relationships, my words, my thoughts, and actions with those principles. Overall, it's meant to be a self-empowerment, self-help guide that can help you start accomplishing your goals by aligning your principles with your actions. The book is available to download for free, and I'll include that link below. But if you're interested, I did recently launch a new online course, which you can find on the University of Reason, aka Autonomy. I partnered with them recently, and they created this whole online course for me. It's 9 weeks long. You can watch and follow along and read the book as I go through each chapter. I read it with you, and I offer some tips and some exercises. There are two different options. You can either do DIY, where you just go through the 9-week course yourself, or if you want to have personal one-on-one sessions with me, there's also an option for that. So check that out, guys. I'll include both links below. Let's get back to the podcast.
So this is a really complicated discussion, which I'm happy to have, but so I'm going to grossly oversimplify. The ideal currency system would be both physical and digital. It would have a balance of both. And it would be governed by a system where there was a faith by the users in the rule of law, okay? And so it would absolutely have digital tools and digital systems, but it would not be 100% digital. In fact, you know, it would be very robustly not all digital. The trick, though, is creating that rule of law that is trusted by all the users. Now, what you've seen is because we have a currency system where the people governing it are not trusted by many parties, those parties have come out and tried to come out with workarounds around the system. So I would describe many of the people who are working on crypto, they're looking for a workaround. Or many of the gold bugs are looking for a workaround. And part of the challenge is, it's not that those systems can't work as a workaround, it's that ultimately, if they are subject to the governance of a group of people who do not respect the rule of law, you're going to run into the same problems with them that you ran off with when you invested in Madoff, or you ran into when, you know, you put money in all the different financial frauds that we've seen over the last 20 years. Not to say that the intention of the system is necessarily fraudulent, but you're subject to a control system which is not trustworthy. So let me give you an example. My concern, I have many concerns about cryptos, because I think one of the things crypto has been used by, it's been used by the central bankers to get the retail investor out of gold and real assets into digital assets in a way that lowers the pressure on inflation, but makes it easier for Bill Gates to own and control and scarf up all the farmland. So if you look at the critical strategic assets we need for resilience, you're taking some of our smartest and bravest freedom fighters and instead pumping and dumping them in digital assets while they let, you know, the bad guys buy up the farmland and the water. So, you know, problem number one is I think it's been used as an op. Problem number two, which is the bigger problem, is if these guys get the vaccine passports, there is no doubt in my mind that they're looking to strip us of all of our assets. We now have over $3 trillion in crypto. The speed at which they can strip and steal those assets are mind-boggling. Now, it's true for all the real assets. You know, if you give a group of untrustworthy people complete control, they can steal everything. But I think the people in the crypto world underestimate the speed. You know, the law and regulations have stayed away and allowed them to flourish and sort of prototype, because I think one of the goals here is to prototype for CBDCs. When the powers that be decide to move in the law and regulation, the speed at which the crypto market can be changed, evolved, knocked down in price, or even destroyed is remarkable. And I don't think that's commonly understood. What that means is you're grappling with the same risks you're grappling with everywhere else, which is, you know, what is the resiliency of this asset? You know, whether it's a piece of farmland or a digital asset, what is its resiliency to moves by law and regulation, particularly law and regulation run for criminal purposes on a very strategic basis? And that's what we're all grappling with. And the reality is, you know, I'm going to be the bad guy. It doesn't matter whether it's Bitcoin or farmland. If there's no rule of law, we're going to be stripped of our assets.
I think you made a number of really great points there. And I wanted to share a little bit of my experience because I think that it does line up with some of what you're saying. So first off, I'll say that in my audience, within those who are going to hear this audience, there's going to be folks who are maybe heavily pro crypto and others who are very skeptical, you know, mix it. I have, you know, everybody in the audience, right?
Right.
And I wrote this piece for Ryan and Last American Vagabond a couple months back called "Is There a Chance to Unite the Pro and Anti-Blockchain Crowds?" and sort of outlining some of the worrisome aspects of what you just covered related to blockchain and the crypto space. For me, I've been in that space as a journalist trying to understand it and reporting on it since 2012. And I actually started first getting paid for some of my journalism in 2013 with crypto. And on the positive side, it has allowed me to not use the banking system, you know, and to avoid them to that degree, and, you know, use it for real assets when possible. Like, for example, the crypto gains that I've been able to hold on over the years are going towards buying the land that I'm going to build my home on here in Mexico, is one positive example. And at the same time, as somebody who has been in that space, I have seen some of that naivete that you were just describing, I think, within the crypto space, where there are those who, for one, those who want to be regulated, who think the answer is we need the government involved in this. That'll, you know, make it legitimate and we'll be, you know, they don't see the problems in that. There are others who are maybe so hyped on crypto that they have a blind spot for any of the negative projects or any of the, you know, the potentially really scary implications of blockchain and things like that. And then there are those who, as I said, are sort of anti, you know, maybe don't even really understand it to much degree, but just are kind of against it because it's a digital tool. And I think that there are value to understanding each of these positions, because there are some positive things that, like you said, with any tool that could be developed, you know. And I think the one important point that stood out to me that you made is the container that we're in, right? These crypto projects and the potential for them. There's people really working night and day to try to create private crypto exchanges outside of the government and these things. And yet they're still operating, as you said, within the larger atmosphere of criminals.
So let me say two things. One of the things I love about crypto and all digital money is right now the transaction fees throughout the globe are way too high. If you look at what transaction fees are paid in the G7 nations, there's no way we can build a global financial system that is inclusive for everybody if they have to pay those fees. So I think part of the reason that there is such a push for crypto is to try and find a way to bring down those fees and create a much more inclusive financial systems. Okay, so that's number one, and that's a good thing. But I will tell you, to me, the greatest proposal I've ever heard for real solutions, and this is for all digital money, it's not just crypto, because the existing, it's whether it's credit cards or any of these digital systems. And that came from the great Bill Binney. He said, we've got to teach the children, the homeschoolers, you know, everybody we can in the educational system, we have to teach the kids how to build homegrown encryption systems. He said, because if every community can keep creating and changing their homegrown encryption systems, he said, it'll drive them nuts. They can't deal with it. And I love that idea. I love the idea of getting enough people educated on how to build encryption systems and doing it on a grassroots basis and constantly changing it, that we can make our digital space safer.
And that might be, you know, par for the course. That just might be the only approach, right? Maybe thinking in terms of we're going to build one system and it's going to be secure forever isn't realistic, right? And as you said,
it's not possible.
Exactly, and being able to constantly evolve. And I want to kind of add to what you're saying there as far as what Bill Binney referenced with getting the youth to understand and to build encryption. That is one other example I would give of, you know, for one, I appreciate the nuance that we're having in this conversation here, because I think some folks who, you know, hear these conversations do tend to take a black or white approach, whether that's pro-crypto or anti-crypto or anti-blockchain, whatever. And I appreciate the nuance that you're outlining here. And for me, again, I know that the banksters and these folks, in their own word, they want to go and find the unbanked of the world. For example, a lot of the population here in Mexico where I live do not use, you know, some people in cities, of course, they got credit cards and all those kinds of things, but there's a lot of people right. totally unconnected, disconnected from that system. And in their view, they want to come find these people, give them digital IDs, vaccine passports, et cetera, so that they can, you know, bring them into the real world. That's their whole, you know, spiel they try to pretend to be behind, right? And then at the same time, there are those who I think do have a freedom mindset and say, well, if I can go into a Mexican village or an Indian village or a Southeast Asian village where people are living on less than a dollar a day and I can teach them encryption, or if I can show them how, I've even seen some examples where people are playing games, but they're earning real world money through that, right? And all of a sudden this village has 10 kids who are now teaching each other how to play this game that they cash out real money to repair their home with, or to kind of empower their communities, right? You can see potential for positive use cases. And at the same time, you can also see, you know, without that nuance, how it normalizes the world they want as well.
So I, in the United States, I live in a farming community where there's a percentage of people who are unbanked. And when I go to the post office, I know because they're all sitting there buying money orders, or they're driving up to the utility to pay their bill in cash. And the reason they're unbanked is because they're very, very smart. They don't want people knowing their business, and that's smart. They're, you know, they're alive and healthier for not letting anybody know their financial transaction business. So, you know, there are many people who are unbanked who don't want to be banked for very, very good reason. You know, and what I have to say is, if you have the opportunity to go to such a village, I would not try and teach them encryption. I'd try and teach them, get them to teach you how to run your life without these tools. Because I go back, we need a system which is both physical and digital, ultimately. And, you know, one of the things we're promoting at Solari is Cash Friday. And we're trying to get all of our subscribers and our audience to use cash on Friday, or some people have gone to cash every day, because that's going to take, you know, that's going to march us away from the vaccine passports and 100% digital system. You know, and part of this is, whether you're engaged with crypto or not, you need to be very interested in what is going on with real assets and control of real assets, whether it's the farmland or the kids who are being poisoned. If we make, you know, if they can take money that they print out of thin air, pump the crypto market and keep us all busy while our children in the next generation are being poisoned and killed, what good is that money going to do us?
Yeah, that's a great point. You're absolutely right. I mean, I think that that could be part of the operation, a little bit of sleight of hand, you know, having people looking in one area while the, as you said, the hard, real physical assets being purchased and the next generations continuing to deal with these same repercussions. So I do have some optimism, but I also tend to temper that with a little bit of the reality that you yourselves and others have outlined.
Can I just say one other thing?
Sure.
Because there are classic rules in the financial world on how you trade a speculative market. And right now, crypto, because it's growing and being developed, is what I would describe as a speculative market. And there are certain rules you follow. And one of the rules, because this is December, that I really want to say to anybody who's got has been doing any trading in crypto, and I'll just talk U.S. because every jurisdiction has different tax rules. But in the U.S., if you swap cryptos, you create a taxable gain, or you create a taxable event. I'm presuming you wouldn't swap unless you probably had a gain, could have a loss. But if you've created taxable gains in 2021, please, please, please make sure before the year closes that you have escrowed money in the currency for which you are liable for taxes. So if you're liable to pay taxes in euros, please get that money out of crypto and put it in euros in anticipation of paying that tax. Because, you know, the game is they'll run up the prices, they'll pump it. You create a taxable gain, then they dump it and you are over a barrel. They played that game in 2017. I keep trying to warn people. And sure enough, they dumped it. And I knew traders who didn't have enough money left in their crypto position to pay the tax bill from last year. And just after that happened, the IRS announced 10,000 auditors just focused on crypto taxes. So, you know, we're in a war, and you are playing war games, you know, in any asset you're in, and you need to be aware of those war games, and you need to not let yourself get hung by not having a hedge position, particularly with respect to taxes or regulation. You know, I always tell anybody who's got crypto, because I'm very concerned about crypto being used to falsify and frame people. I've been through a process where, you know, the feds have tried to frame me, and they falsified evidence on a repeated basis. And one of the reasons they couldn't was, you know, I had command and control of the bank records, and my bank records could prove that what they were saying was false. But if you, you know, you will not necessarily have that from your crypto exchange. So make sure you have in multiple locations, including completely offline, paper records too. And the best thing is if you can have it with a friend, a trustworthy friend or an accountant or a CPA or a lawyer, please make sure you have offline copies of all your positions and trades so that you can document and prove and nobody can frame you.
Yeah, that's good advice there. I definitely think that whole aspect of we'll switch gears in just a moment. But, you know, one comment on that, I think it's interesting to see the IRS making their new rules and attempting. And honestly, I would say most of the crypto folks that I know who are invested are just totally ignoring them. Now, maybe in the long term, that might be a bad thing as far as what you're putting out there.
I'll tell you what that is in the long run. That's a control file. Yeah. That's a control file. You do what they say or they put you in jail because they've got you. And yeah, if you think they don't know, they know. They've got the records.
And I think especially for the vast majority of people, this is something that I've tried to contend with, is that the folks that say in the more mainstream financial world are just barely even financially aware who hear about crypto. They just hear people are making money. So they go through Robinhood or you know, the sort of mainstream websites that have their ID, their name, there's no privacy involved in that. So it's not like it's hard to find those folks who are very openly buying and trading crypto. And I think that's some good advice you offer there. I wanted to switch gears a little bit here. First, thank you again for kind of spending some time on that topic. I think it's something people enjoy your perspective on, and we're looking forward to hearing, you know, more from you.
Really, my impression is many people don't enjoy my perspective.
I think they do. I think that, you know, of course, people maybe who are crypto, like pro crypto, as I said, and can't see past those blinders might get offended or whatever. But I think that hopefully we've cultivated an audience here who understands the nuance. And maybe some people are shouting at the screen right now and others are saying, yes, you know, I get
well,
what you're saying.
I think crypto has given a lot of people, first, it's given a lot of people, you know, wonderful profits. And, you know, having been in the financial markets for decades, if it makes me money, it's hard not to love it, right? But the other thing is, I think you have a lot of people who want to be free, and it's given them hope that they can be free. And the problem is, you know, there's a difference between something that makes you free or an op where you're running around in the Wild West because they're letting you and then they're ready to move in. So if you go to Solari, and I think it's in the library, you might have to go to the library. I did a very serious due diligence on Bitcoin in 2017 and then did a Solari report that's public called Bitcoin the Op, and described, and I also had several of my attorneys write a paper on the U.S. tax, you know, sort of tax compliance issues if you're concerned about taxes, and that's also there.
I will include that in the show notes. I'll pull that up and get that everybody. I see it right here, Bitcoin the Op. So we'll include that for those who want to dive deeper into that. I wanted to talk a little bit more, maybe a little bit more personal if possible. And I don't know your background religiously, spiritually, et cetera, and you don't have to share anything you want. But I wanted to just kind of probe in that area because I'm not sure if you've come away with this feeling. You've been doing this kind of important work for a while, but what I've been experiencing and what I've been hearing from many folks, I just spent 2 months traveling the United States doing a speaking tour, trying to get people to really think about the vaccine passport and everything that's coming. And one of the things that I heard over and over is that so many people are experiencing sort of a moment of, this is why I'm here. I think this is why God, or this is why I was born. This is, you know, whatever words you want to put it in. And I'm just curious for you, if you feel this is, you know, if this unprecedented time we're in is something unique or is just, you know, another evolution of human, you know, the human species, and how you as an individual are kind of handling, taking everything on.
So I went through a process in the 90s where I had to, you know, I was a wealthy, successful person with a great reputation. And I went through a process of 18 audits and investigations, 12 pieces of litigation, a smear campaign and physical harassment that went on for years and years and years. And in that process, I had to decide, you know, whose side was I on, and what did I want to do about it? And the process required me to go from being very wealthy and successful to completely isolated and in living in extreme poverty. And, you know, you have your utilities shut off, you get up in the morning, you don't know how you're going to buy food that week. And you go through a process where you get unbelievably clear about what you care about, what your values are. It's very cleansing. In fact, we have an article at Salaria called Come In Clean that was inspired by it. And in the process, I ended up going back to, I had grown up in an African-American community, and I knew the African-American church knew how to deal with beatdowns and knew how to protect themselves with genocide. And I went back to a wonderful church in Washington that had a Bible Institute. I'm a Christian. And I studied spiritual warfare for 2.5 years, and it saved my life. And one of the things I discovered, that what is going on in the invisible realms and energetically and spiritually on this planet is far more, you know, I'd grown up as a hyper-materialist on Wall Street. And I discovered that, you know, the invisible realms on this planet are far more powerful. And whatever is going on interdimensionally, you know, it's the most powerful force on the planet. And it completely changed my framework. And I moved from a person who had, you know, a 10-year plan, a 5-year plan, and a 1-year plan, to somebody who got up every morning and said, my plan is to live in right relationship with the Lord today. And it was completely converting from a hyper-materialist framework to a spiritual framework. I absolutely believe that our freedom comes to us by divine authority. I believe intelligence on this planet is divine, and you know, the divine intelligence has woven wisdom into all aspects of the universe, and that's my birthright. And I'd much rather be dead than be a slave. You know, to me, freedom is more important than even life itself. So I absolutely believe our souls are immortal. And I think part of what's going on here is there is a desire to basically control and destroy people's immortal soul. And when we face the evil that we're facing, what you have to decide is, you know, yes, you have a material life, but you also have an immortal soul. Don't let them put you into a state of fear with respect to your mortal life that gets you to compromise your immortal soul. So I believe, first and foremost, this is a 10,000-year-old plus spiritual battle. And this, you know, we cannot win this without looking at it spiritually, approaching it spiritually, and without spiritual tools.
That's so great. I appreciate you sharing that background. And, you know, my website is The Conscious Resistance, and I've focused for years on the intersection of, as you said, like, to me, freedom and the spiritual search for meaning, that deeper search, that deeper connection to the divine. It took me getting addicted to drugs and going to prison to find that connection for myself. But once I did, and then I discovered all this sort of work, this came afterwards, the spiritual journey kind of happened first. It became so apparent to me that how intertwined these experiences are. And as you said, it is a spiritual battle. We have the material, we have the physical, but without a doubt, we cannot ignore the other aspect that's going on here. So I'm really, really pleased to hear you share that. And, you know,
right. Let me take it back to currency, sure. though. Remember when I said, you know, the ideal system has physical and digital, but it's governed by the rule of law. That rule of law is not just the formal law, it's the cultural law, it's the field, it's the morphogenic field. You know, that's where the covenant, our deepest covenant with each other, you know, our deepest covenant in community is in that, in the creation and the nurturing and the maintenance of that field. And without that, we can't have a human civilization. And I think what Mr. Global is trying to do is get us to resonate with a machine so he can control that field. And what we have to do, you know, because love is the answer, we have to say, no, that field has got to be infused with the divine intelligence and life, and we have to resonate with each other.
Couldn't have said it better myself. We have to resonate with each other, right? And I think that that is one of the experiences folks are having right now, is that I can say, and I know within your work as well, that the different communities that gather around like your content, I'm a part of the Freedom Cell Network, and we've been encouraging people for years to organize in local decentralized groups. Prior to COVID, we probably had about 2,000 to 3,000 people on the website and just the movement broadly. Now we have over 30,000 people from around the world who are buying land together. They're growing food together. They're pulling the money out of the banks. They're pulling the kids out of the school. But what I think is even more important is they're finding that connection. I mean, I can't tell you the amount of people who told me when we were traveling the U.S. last year, I thought I was so alone. You know, the pandemic started and I realized, I just thought I was crazy. And then I used the website or I met somebody through this group or that group. And now I realize that I do have other people. And some of it is definitely people who are finding spiritual connection and religious connection together.
So
I mean, it's so, so important.
I used to have a wonderful ally who, and I've never been able to find this word. And since you're in Latin America, you can find it for me, Derek. It was, she said it was Chitino. She said it was a Brazilian term. So maybe it was from the Portuguese, but as she said, is Jatino, the magic that comes in dangerous times.
I like that. I think that's what we're dealing with right now, right? The magic that comes in dangerous
times. That's how
times.
You have these, I'll tell you funny, I just told this to somebody, so forgive me for telling it twice today. I just had in the last month two times when I was booted out of a restaurant or not allowed in because I didn't have a QR code. And I'm not getting a QR code. And my first reaction when it happened, the first time I started to laugh and I thought, I wonder what they're putting in the food here. But the second reaction was, in both cases, what happened next just felt like magic. It felt like the world was dividing and I was going into this magical world where it was going to be easy to find each other.
I think that is one of the things that is happening, you know, for all the, you know, as we're talking about the spiritual nature of this, right, I do believe in equal and opposite reactions. And the harder they push, the predator class push, the more people ask questions, the more people start seeking answers, the more people come to your content, they come to my content, they start seeking solutions, most importantly. And that is, to me, the silver lining, right? I mean, COVID brought on this big thing. We can see what we're facing now. It doesn't seem so far away for many of us. Before, maybe they thought, yeah, there's some people working on a financial new world order, but that seems, you know, far off. Now it's staring you in the face. And maybe that is what we needed to get our collective species to step up to the plate and rise to the occasion. I believe that is what we're going through right now. And for us, the People's Reset, the Greater Reset is very much a part of that. And we are, as I mentioned earlier, everybody, we are gonna have Catherine speaking at the event. We have so many other great speakers, Foster Gamble, RFK Jr., a lot of really important thinkers. Some you may know and others hopefully you will get to know as the event happens. James Corbett, of course, who are going to be focused on solutions. And Catherine, we're going to have you speaking on our day, which is dedicated to parallel networks and talking to people. How do we build, you know, whether it's parallel economy, parallel spiritual networks, you know, building this next stage. And I think you're going to have a lot of exciting things to share to the conversation. So anything you'd like to say as we wrap up here, but whether about the People's Reset or just any closing thoughts, feel free to share.
You know, I feel we're going into a year that is going to have just dramatic change impacting all of our lives. And the one thing I would say to everyone is, you know, I hate to sound like a retired investment advisor, but that's what I am. You really need to do a time budget for 2022. and look at your time. I would encourage you to look at our article, Coming Clean, and figure out how can you get out of your life anybody who's draining or wasting your time, and how can you reinvest your time to build the kind of world you want to live in instead of responding constantly to, you know, to events that are draining your time. So, 2022 is going to be a war year, and it's unbelievably important that you invest your time in a way that helps you succeed, and that gives you the energy to help the people around you. So I would just say, you know, we do this every year in our annual wrap-up. Get ready, get ready, get ready, because we're in for a wild ride.
Yeah, absolutely. I think 2022 is going to be an interesting, tough year. And you're correct that the more self-aware we are, both as individuals and our finances and our families and our connections, then the better off we're going to be into the future. Everyone, thank you so much for joining us today. I will include all of the reference links, Coming Clean, the Bitcoin op, your other articles that you mentioned will all be in the show notes. And of course, a link to the Solari report. Thank you so much for all the work you do, Catherine, and for continuing to put the message out there. And everyone listening, I hope that you found value in this conversation. Remember that I started this podcast this year, the Activation Podcast, focused on solutions on how to get you activated, get you motivated, inspired to take real world steps in the face of what we are dealing with here. Please take the advice given by Catherine seriously, implement it in your life to the best degree that you can, and think about how you're going to continue to protect your family and thrive into this future that we're facing. I very much appreciate your time. As always, remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, and you are free. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Activation Podcast. You can find the archives of our show on Spotify, Pinecast, Odyssey, Rockfin, and theconsciousresistance.com.